With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. Cotton acreage dropped to historic low in the state due to weather and prices. For the first time in a century, California cotton acreage will likely drop to fewer than 100,000 acres, due in part to soggy ground at planting and better prices for competing crops. Aaron Barcelos, a partner in the family-owned Abar Ag Enterprises in Fresno County, said cold, wet weather along with low prices prompted them to reduce Pima plantings this year. Without those factors, he said they probably would have doubled the acreage they planted. In the late 1970s and early 1980s, cotton was king in the San Joaquin Valley, maxing out at 1.6 million planted acres. That was today's California Farm Bureau Food and Farm News Report, and now let's get into today's show headlines. The DWR gives the approval of 10 more GSPs. 10 new groundwater sustainability plans have been approved by the Department of Water Resources. The approved basins include East Bay Plain, East Contra Costa, Ukai Valley, Sierra Valley, North San Benito, North American, South American, Butte, Vina, and Wyandotte Creek. And while the DWR has determined 6 groundwater basins inadequate and those basins are gearing up for probationary hearings in the coming months, it has now approved 40 GSPs to date. DWR Director of Groundwater Management Paul Goslin says, quote, "Local groundwater sustainability agencies have put a tremendous amount of work into these plans that will have long-term benefits for communities, agriculture, and the environment across California." Adding, quote, "These approved plans will continue to address the impacts of ongoing weather extremes associated with climate change to ensure that communities remain safe and resilient to the challenges of a hotter, drier future in California." Stay tuned to AgNet West and this radio station as we continue to provide you with coverage on this topic. But for right now, here's AgNet West Brian Derman with more agriculture news.
The recent forecast from the U.S. Department of Agriculture highlights a small decline in California citrus production. USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service is expecting all orange production for California to be 44 million boxes, a small decrease from the June forecast of 45.1 million. Production for the previous season was 39.1 million boxes and 49 million for the 2020-2021 season. A major driver for the forecasted decrease is Valencia production is expected to drop down to 7 million boxes. The lemon forecast is now also down 3 million boxes from June, estimated at 20 million. Tangerines and tangelos increased by 1 million boxes to a total forecast of 22 million. Grapefruit expectations remain the same as the June forecast at 4.2 million boxes, a 2% increase from the previous season. Some weeds may be left alone in orchards to cut back on input costs. Extension weed science specialist at UC Davis, Brad Hansen, described the type of weed considerations to think about when contemplating scaling back on management approaches.
Direct competition in an established orchard is probably not great from, you know, annual weeds. It will reduce the efficiency of the system to a small degree, right? Those weeds are going to use fertilizer, they're going to use water, but that might be something you could live with because of the cost of the operations to control them might outweigh the, you know, negative aspects of the water use, for example. One of the things to think about there is some weeds are going to last longer in the soil environment. So weeds with hard seeds that are more persistent in the soil seed bank, those might be ones I try to control. Other weeds are much less persistent. And maybe, I, you know, if I let them go for a year, I might be able to get them cleaned up again within a couple of years. So thinking a little bit about the seed bank.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Thanks, Brian, and stay tuned as we'll have more of the day's agriculture news and farm features here on the AgNet News Hour. Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search our name of AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet West. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
If your soil could talk, what would it say? If it's healthy, it may already be saying some good things about your future. Because farmers who use soil health building systems that include no-till, cover crops, and diverse species and rotations report greater productivity, profitability, and resiliency to weather extremes. Learn more about what your soil is saying about its health and your future. Contact your local USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service office today. This message brought to you by USDA and this radio station.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, organic dairy producers have more time to submit applications for the USDA's Organic Dairy Marketing Assistance Program. Applications originally were due last week, but USDA has extended the deadline. The program was established to help mitigate several factors that have created unique hardships in the organic dairy industry. John Burge, Acting Deputy Administrator for Farm Programs at the Farm Service Agency, says the funds will assist with projected marketing costs in 2023, calculated using their marketing costs in 2022.
Several weeks ago, we announced $104 million available to organic dairy operations to assist with projected marketing costs in 2023. And that program is designed to help producers mitigate some of the market volatility that they're experiencing because of higher input and transportation costs and, you know, unstable feed supply. So we made that available earlier in the year, and we extended the deadline just to ensure that everybody that is interested and or eligible for that program can get into our offices. So we extended it to August 11th. We initially opened it up on May 24th, and we anticipate hopefully a number of producers coming in and seeing their county office and seeing what we might be able to do for them.
He says the qualifications are pretty simple.
Well, the main thing that folks need to do is when they come in to apply, the organic dairy operations are required to provide USDA their certification of organic status, confirming that their operation is an organic dairy and has been in 2023 and 2022, along with any certification of milk production in hundredweight. And aside from that, we'll take it from there. We'll fill out the applications and see about their eligibility, and we'll go from there. And, you know, just to be sure that producers understand, that $104 million allows us to make an initial payment to the producers, and it's factored at 75%, which means that we may have some money left over, and if funds remain at the end of that application period, including this extension, an additional payment not to exceed the remaining 25% may be issued to those producers as well. So it could potentially be a really good deal for these folks to help with all of these costs that are outside of their control.
Birch says any organic dairy can apply.
Yeah, any organic dairy operation, including cows, goats, and sheep, is eligible under this program. And we've had a number of people from all three of those different categories come to our office, and we're looking forward to seeing the rest.
As far as the waiting period to get the funds, he expects things to move quickly.
Well, I think that we're going to be ready to do the calculations as soon as the application period ends. Now, that keeping in mind that some of these operations are in some of these states that have been experiencing some pretty significant flooding, you know, that may delay things just a bit because if they can't get into the office by the application period, there may be an opportunity to put them on a register, which means they had an appointment, but were unable to make the appointment, so we can accept that application as late filed. So I anticipate, though, that very shortly after the sign-up period ends, we'll be doing those calculations, getting the payments out.
The program provides financial assistance that will immediately support certified organic dairy operations during 2023, keeping organic dairy operations sustainable until the market returns to more normal conditions. It complements other assistance available to dairy producers, including the dairy margin coverage and supplemental DMC, with more than $300 million in benefits paid for the 2023 program year to date. Once again, to apply, producers should contact FSA at their local USDA service center. To complete the application, producers must certify to pounds of 2022 milk production, show documentation of their organic certification, and submit a completed application form. That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's livestock report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, research conducted by the National Dairy Council was recently reinforced. AgNet Media's Will Jordan has more details.
A new study recently published in the European Heart Journal concluded that whole-fat dairy serves as a heart-healthy source of nutrition and is associated with lower risk of cardiovascular disease. To learn more about the heart healthfulness of dairy, we visited with Dr. Chris Cefelli, Senior Vice President of Nutrition Research for the National Dairy Council.
This new study reinforced what we at National Dairy Council have shown in over 70 farmer-funded research studies, and that is that whole milk, cheese, and yogurt are part of a healthy eating pattern. This study was really, really cool because what the investigators did is they developed a new healthy diet score, and that diet score was based on data collected from over 21 countries and included data points on about 150,000 people. And this healthy diet score, the healthiest score that they could put together, included dairy foods, and most of that dairy foods was whole fat sources. And again, this is something that the farmers intuitively have known, and we at National Dairy Council through our nutrition research program have shown through peer-reviewed publication that whole milk dairy products are healthy, they can fit into multiple eating patterns, and are nutritionally or beneficially linked to things like cardiovascular disease or type 2 diabetes.
For Agnet Media, I'm Will Jordan.
Thanks, Will. And the National Association of Conservation Districts recently held a stakeholder session. It focused on regenerative grazing and public lands and conservation leasing as part of NACD's summer meeting. The event took place up in Bismarck, North Dakota, and the U.S. Bureau of Land Management, or BLM, was invited to participate. NACD notes this was a key opportunity for conservation districts and other local leaders and voices to engage in open dialogue with the BLM about conservation efforts on private and public lands across the country. If you remember back in April, the BLM released a proposed rule to bolster conservation on public lands within the agency's multiple-use framework. And they received hundreds of thousands of public comments, including those from NACD. So during the recent stakeholder session, BLM Senior Policy Advisor Errol Rice outlined the Bureau's motivation behind the rule. He provided clarifications and answered questions about conservation and the multiple-use framework and opportunities for locally led conservation to help support the health, diversity, and productivity of public lands. He emphasized the BLM's commitment to continuing to work with local communities and stakeholders to identify concerns and address questions related to conservation leasing, implementation, and interactions with additional land uses. He stated this is an opportunity to develop a rule that addresses the growing issues on the landscape consistent with the multiple-use framework under the Federal Land Policy and Management Act. Now, participants did gain some valuable insights into the BLM's proposed rule and how it will interact with important issues such as grazing. To learn more about this, go to the National Association of Conservation Districts website, nacdnet.org. I'm Randall Wiseman for Agnet West.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Why do you listen?
I just want to stay informed while I'm on the go.
News on the radio, it's nice because it's just a quick snippet and I don't have to go searching for it or grab a paper.
I listen to radio because anywhere that I'm going, I'm listening to music or I'm listening to a talk show or I'm just trying to stay up on current events.
I always turn into the radio to see if I need to take shelter, where it's hitting, to see what I need to be preparing for.
Why do you listen? Go to whyilisten.com, tell us why you listen, and you have a chance to win $500. Visit whyilisten.com today.
You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
Farm bill priorities for the biotech industry. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. The Biotechnology Innovation Organization, or BIO, says the next farm bill offers opportunities to invest in long-term food security, climate resiliency, and growing the national bioeconomy. The group has submitted recommendations to the agriculture committees in both chambers of Congress as they work toward writing the new legislation. BIO's Vice President of Agriculture and Environment says a farm bill centered on innovation stands to incentivize the adoption of cutting-edge technologies and practices, resulting in benefits to the environment and rural economies. Among their recommendations, they say they'd like increased funding for bio-based markets or bio-preferred programs, which direct federal agencies to increase their bio-based and renewable product purchases. They'd like to see Congress increase funding and make administrative improvements to the federal program to help build or retrofit facilities to produce advanced biofuels, renewable chemicals, and other bio-based products. I'm Sabrina Halverson for Agnet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCohen. If the government says your land is habitat for an endangered or threatened species, your farming and ranching activities can be significantly impacted. A rule change by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service lists the lesser prairie chicken as threatened in a larger territory in the Great Plains. Some farmers, ranchers, and counties in these areas have challenged the rule in court. The Endangered Species Act has the potential to substantially restrict ag activities because many of the protections provided for threatened and endangered species under the Act extend to species on private land. A recent rule change by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has extended federal protection to the lesser prairie chicken over more private land. Farmers, ranchers, and counties in western Kansas have filed a legal challenge against the new rule, claiming that it will reduce the value of the impacted land, bar routine ag activities, and impose greater financial burdens on subject counties. The lawsuit claims that the rule was not properly developed and that the Fish and Wildlife Service exceeded its statutory authority and failed to account for the rule's impact on small entities, a requirement of another federal law. The plaintiffs are seeking that the rule be set aside and a new rule developed that closely follows existing legal requirements. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCohen.
Last Friday's USDA twice yearly cattle inventory report had more minus signs than my checking account.
Well, we are still in the contractionary mode.
Just like my bank account. That's USDA livestock analyst Shale Shagum. He says nothing in the latest cattle report even suggests a turnaround in the continued beef herd reduction. For example, right off the top of the bat here, the entire U.S. cattle inventory July 1st, 95.9 million head, 3% fewer than July 1st of last year. The beef cow number, 29.4 million head, also 3% down from a year ago. And Shagum says if you dig down even further into the report,
the number of heifers being retained for beef cow replacement was down 2%. The number of beef cows in actuality was down 3%. So again, it's a smaller pool of breeding stock as of July 1st, which is definitely an indication of a delay in the expansion.
USDA also has issued a cattle feedlot report, which gives us a snapshot of the number of heifers and heifer calves in feedlots.
And the number of heifers and heifer calves as a proportion of the total number of animals on feed on July 1st was about 39.9% of the total number of animals on feed, compared to about 39.2% a year ago. So, again, we are looking at a larger proportion of heifers on feed, a smaller proportion of heifers being retained for breeding, and a smaller number of cows available.
And, of course, that means no expansion plans in sight. One main reason for that,
very low levels of forage available for producers.
Yes, Shagum says pastures in some areas, yes, they've started to perk up after a long drought, but
you probably have to wait at least a year for some of the rootstock to regenerate, for the grass to begin to grow again. So, you know, again, despite the fact that rains have helped with conditions, it's going to take a while before we come out of those very poor pasture conditions that we've seen.
And even a longer while before we see meaningful growth in the beef herd and in beef production.
Producers would have to retain those heifers, wait for them to hit maturity. And then, again, once you breed a heifer or a cow, it's 9 months to give birth. And then you're talking pretty close to a year and a half between the time that calf is born and the time it's weaned, put on feed, then comes out of the feedlot as fed beef.
All in all, basically a two-year process. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
How are GMO plants made? First, scientists look for a desired trait in a plant, animal, or even bacteria. It could be a trait like resistance to drought, insects, or viruses. Then they copy the gene that contains that trait and insert it into the DNA of the plant they want to improve. Scientists then grow that plant to see if it adopts the desired trait. Feed your mind with more GMO facts on FDA's website.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
Well, as we close out the month of July today, how have our 48 commodities fared during the month? I'm Mark Oppold with your bottom line report, brought to you by Helena. We track 48 different commodities on a daily basis at the bottom line report, including, of course, grains, livestock, but also precious metals, energies, financials, and more. Well, today, the last trading day of July, has been a good month overall for a majority of our 48 commodities. Leading the way, orange juice up 22% for the month, followed by wheat up 15%, of course, helped out by world events. Corn jumped 13%. For the month, oats up 12%, the only agricultural commodity to really fall in the red for the month, feeder cattle down 0.5%. Ethanol was down 1.25%, but at the very bottom of our 48 list, lean hogs down 9% during the month of July. This is the bottom line report. Manage your in-season nutrition with flexible in-season applications of great products like Coron Metra. Visit HelenaAgra.com to learn more. USDA and private crop scouts are handing their data to USDA statisticians getting ready for that August 11th crop report. That's our bottom line. I'm Mark Oppold, wishing you a profitable day and a profitable week ahead.
Studying agribusiness concentration and competition. USDA's Rod Bain talks with economic researcher James McDonald.
What do the food retail, meat packing, and seed industries have in common? A recent USDA economic research study revealed those three industries have in recent years undergone transformation into highly concentrated sectors of the food and farm economy.
And what we're trying to do is explain those transformations, that is, how those industries became concentrated, and explain the impacts of that concentration.
James McDonald of the Economic Research Service explains why those three categories were the subject of focus in the USDA report.
We chose these three sectors because they've had really striking transformations in how business is organized within each sector over the last 20 or 30 years. And as part of that, many specific markets within each sector have become highly concentrated with just a few producers.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Looking at trends of consolidation in agribusiness and what those trends could mean. A recent USDA study looks at trends of concentration in agribusiness and what that means regarding competition within certain industries. Rod Bain has more.
What do the food retail, meat packing, and seed industries have in common? A recent USDA economic research study revealed those three industries have in recent years undergone transformation into highly concentrated sectors of the food and farm economy.
And what we're trying to do is explain those transformations, that is, how those industries became concentrated, and explain the impacts of that concentration.
James McDonald of the Economic Research Service explains why those three categories were the subject of focus in the USDA report.
We chose these three sectors because they've had really striking transformations in how business is organized within each sector over the last 20 or 30 years. And as part of that, many specific markets within each sector have become highly concentrated with just a few producers.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
For more agriculture news, head to our website at agnetwest.com. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
The latest round of urban agriculture and innovative production investments were recently announced in the form of grant awards from USDA.
We selected 25 recipients under the fiscal year 23 solicitation. The total amount that we're awarding is going to be about $7.4 million to really support urban agriculture and innovative producers throughout the country.
Office of Urban Ag and Innovative Production Director Brian Gussie says the breakdown of grant awards fall into two categories: planting projects?
The planting projects are expected to provide an early stage investment in new and startup activities with surveys, assessments, design and planning, business plan creation, feasibility studies, municipal policy and zoning best practices.
And implementation projects.
These are really designed to accelerate urban, indoor, and other agricultural practices that serve multiple farmers and improve local food access. They may support infrastructure needs, emerging technologies, education, and urban farming policy implementation.
Providing examples of recent grant recipients to illustrate each category, Gussie starts with two planting projects receiving Urban Ag and Innovative Production funding.
One is in Austin, Texas, working with the Austin Youth and Community Farm, which is going to increase food equity in Travis County, Texas, by using regenerative farming and natural resource conservation practices to double food production on two urban farms. And then over across the country in Kent, Washington, at the Living Well Kent, the program there plans to come up with plans that will help transform the food production system to improve food security with some of the historically marginalized BIPOC communities in Kent, Washington.
Meanwhile, among implementation projects,
two, for example, one is in Athens, Georgia. It's the Athens Land Trust, which will provide locally grown food to Athens community and offer workshops, paid employment for youth, and business opportunities for beginning and historically underserved farmers. And then on the Osage Nation in Oklahoma, the project there plans to install supplemental lighting for vegetable production facilities and systems, along with installing a solar field and serve as a guide for Native nations looking to implement similar innovative agricultural systems.
He adds the grants are some of the latest efforts to support the broad array of systems and examples under the Urban Ag umbrella.
There's no one-size-fits-all. You might have seen urban agriculture in a large farm operation, a for-profit on the outskirts of the city or even within a city limits or in a suburban area. But also, we work very closely with small-scale operations that might be more community-based, that aren't necessarily looking to turn a profit. Instead, they're growing produce to provide to local food banks or through other community access avenues. There's plenty of farms that work with farmers markets. There's also a lot of innovative operations that we support both in urban and rural areas throughout the country.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them, just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
Welcome back to the show. Today we have part two of my conversation with Stanislaus County Farm Bureau's Anna Genesi and Stanislaus County Nursery owner Tim Roos. He's also part of the county's workforce development program. We talked a bit about how, Anna, you said there's this attitude about wanting to do things when they want to do it and on their own circumstances. So how do we think that, or how are current employers attracting that next generation if folks who are actively working, don't really want to, or they're not being as reliable? Is it with incentives? I'm not really sure. What do you guys think?
I think that's the million-dollar question, right? Daniel, I honestly don't know. I think, I can speak personally that obviously working for a company or industry that you feel passionate about, I think the goal is always for work not to feel like work, right? I'm lucky that I get paid to do the things that I like to do. But there's definitely like the shift of, it seems like this next generation coming into this, their working years is looking for a company that they believe in, like ethically, you know, that they're that the company culture matches their perspective on life. The other thing that seems to be overwhelming is flexibility. You know, I think COVID truly impacted this. Folks are wanting to work remotely when they want to. Just a recent conversation that I had with Chris, who's with Workforce Development, where the county is beginning to ask their employees who were allowed to work remotely during COVID to come back and to spend some more time in office. And they are getting a lot of pushback. People have gotten used to working remotely. And I think there's pros and cons. I mean, I think there's things that can get done successfully while working from home. And then I also think that there's value in the face-to-face conversation with your team, right? That's where collaboration and brainstorming happen. So, yeah, I don't know if Tim wants to speak a little bit to, you know, his group of folks.
Yeah, I was going to add from a personal standpoint, we've actually found that the labor market in the last 18 months has been more advantageous than it was maybe even 2 and 3 years ago. And I don't know what that stems from. I know that myself as well with the changing labor laws and the pay rates, we've chosen to work less hours so that we don't get handcuffed by overtime. And so we end up covering, we have a larger pool that we're dealing with. We have a larger payroll from a numbers standpoint, but from a payroll standpoint, it's pretty consistent. And so we have allowed that flexibility because we have extra people that are working. And so other people have just covered for the time off or the ability to be able to do something different for even 3 or 4 days. This is the first time in my time period of being involved in agriculture where you have people coming up and workers coming up and saying, hey, can I take 4 or 5 days off? I need to do this. And I would like to, you know, I've got a side gig or something like that. And so we've, at this point in time, we've accommodated that. And the only way we're able to do that is by carrying a larger force and our labor, you know, our final payroll numbers end up being a little higher, but being consistent.
Tim, you talked about, you know, you've been in the industry for a while and you started your own nursery. And, you know, in my opinion, I would consider that as starting a new business or maybe becoming a beginning farmer or rancher. And I recently read that, you know, the average age of the beginning farmer is 46, and whereas the overall age of the farmer is 57. And I often hear about farmers leaving the industry because of said regulations or because there's a lack of participation by, you know, a reliable workforce or just the markets are too volatile or whatever the, you know, case may be. So why do you guys think it is that there's maybe less folks jumping in and more folks leaving the industry?
Well, I would say that farming takes an extreme amount of capital. And I don't know any 25-year-olds that are sitting on a pile of cash that they're looking at rolling into pieces of land. And we've had in my particular industry, and it's not hot now because the almond and walnut prices is suppressed. But we've had some good years. And so people are still riding on that investment money that they've rolled forward rather than paying taxes with. And so I think we're still seeing that effect. It'll be real interesting to see, you know, if there is no light at the end of the tunnel, which it seems that there are some positive things being done, whether that'll change. But it is definitely true that, yeah, most of the people that we do business with, at least the decision makers are well-aged, let's just say, like good ones.
When it comes to like the workforce development programs that you're a part of, or, you know, I know you're with the county, but even programs that are offered through USDA or CDFA, Farm Bureau programs, do they work with beginning farmers and ranchers? Or is it just for folks who are established business owners and who are looking to, like you said, upskill
their employees? I think there's both. You know, from a Farm Bureau perspective, you know, we have our Young Farmers and Ranchers group, which often folks think is very social, and it can be, but we've structured ours. That group gets together every other month, And one time it's a social farm tour, you know, kind of fun. And then the next time we're bringing in industry specialists. So we've had, you know, ag lending come in and talk to that age group about things that you should do before you ask for a loan. We've had a local insurance company come and say things that you should consider when purchasing insurance for your business for the first time. So that's something that we just here as a county farm bureau offer to that 18 to 35 year old range. But I know, you know, through FSA and USDA, there's all kinds of programs for new farmers, grant funding available for new farmers. However, like everything associated with the government, there is a ton of paperwork involved. So be ready to, you know, provide a ton of information in order to get it off the ground. And it's very slow. And I can speak to that just personally doing this workforce development project with the county. You know, from a Farm Bureau perspective, we're used to like having a couple ideas, finding a sponsor or figuring out in the budget how we can do it and then executing, right? And doing this workforce development and having the funds, the purse strings tied federally, there are a lot more hoops to jump through, but the money's there if you're patient, and not one of my strongest attributes.
Right. They're going to make you work for
them. Yes, absolutely.
And I would say from a workforce development standpoint, there's other programs that they have, but they're more organizational in the fact that of internships, of paid internships, and the Farm Bureau has started to go in those directions as far as being able to explore the steps of procuring those internships. I think that's more driven from the companies themselves than the young individual that's looking at getting into the farming business themselves. But I wouldn't say that if someone was motivated enough that they could get the traction of workforce development, that they could take that program to the business that they're interested in working for and setting up that type of program as well. That is at least something that I think would be neat to see as well. Workforce development also has job centers in the different communities. I think there's 4 or 5 that I can think of in our county, and they help with different, you know, job search assistance and advising and those type of things, answering some of the same questions that Canada, you know, with the Farm Bureau. But I think the Farm Bureau would be more ag specific than say what the workforce development is accomplishing.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Daniel Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Daniel Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
The Organic Fertilizer Association of California will be hosting a continuing education seminar in Tulare. OFAC spokesperson Miranda Driver said the Sustainable Pest Management and Production Seminar will be taking place at the International Agri Center in Tulare on August 10th.
Registration opens at 7:30 and our last speaker ends at 2:30. We're offering 4.5 hours of DPR credits and 6.5 hours of CCA credits. We have a wide range of topics that we're going to be covering. Obviously, with those DPR units, we're going to have some laws and regulations, and then IPM, everything from mating disruption to vegetable diseases, some citrus IPM and management, And then our ag commissioner is going to be talking through the laws and regulations. And then for the CCAs, we also have some other interesting talks from a variety of speakers for nutrient management. One of our more interesting ones that I think people are really going to like is we have Jenny Garley, who's the chief science officer of New Age Laboratories. She's coming over from the Central Coast, and she's going to be talking about sap analysis and interpretation, which is a more of a new practice, but it's gaining a lot of traction and growers are really finding that to be valuable. So we're looking forward to that talk as well.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
House bill would help farmers and ranchers combat drought. Congressman Yadira Caraveo of Colorado introduced a bill that would help family farmers and ranchers fight drought. The Voluntary Groundwater Conservation Act gives farmers and ranchers the flexibility they need to protect groundwater sources while also keeping agricultural lands and production under a new voluntary groundwater easement program. The legislation comes as aquifers in the western U.S., a crucial source of water for rural communities and farmers, are in decline. The bill creates a new groundwater conservation easement program at USDA to encourage voluntary compensated reductions in groundwater consumption on agricultural land and advance local, regional, or state groundwater management goals. Additionally, it will guarantee long-term management flexibility for a producer to continue farming and choose how they reduce water use, as long as they conserve the amount they've committed to reducing. Producers would also get paid based on the market value for water rights instead of per acre. An AFB contributed to that report.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.